I'm chairing the session, and I think that's a good thing. I kind of hinted very, very strongly in my presentation before that, you know, I'd like more expert support, which I recognise isn't free, but I'd like to be able to get more expert support and have more academics arguing in ways that help transport campaigners, or at least actually I think they kind of do, but not in the right sort of forums for us to be able to push them out. So how can we, you know, do more, and should we? Is that the question? Should we?
Can and should do it.
Can and should academics engage in transport campaigning? So my answer is yes. And to talk about that, we have short contributions, apparently, from, first of all, Steve Melia, who is a senior... Is it Melia or Melia?
Melia.
Who is senior lecturer in transport and planning at the University of the West of England. He's a former parliamentary candidate for the Lib Dems, and an environmental campaigner, journalist, and has a new book coming out called Urban Transport Without the Hot Air in early 2050. And has lots to say on this topic.
Thank you. Question of two parts, really. Can and should transport researchers get involved in campaigning? Clearly, to take the first one, the answer, I guess, must be yes, because many clearly do. And there are certain implications to that. Should opens up obviously a whole wider series of sort of moral as well as sort of practical questions. I was a campaigner long before I became an academic. In fact, it was partly through campaigning that I decided I really need to go and learn about this stuff properly. Therefore, I packed my job in to do a PhD relatively sort of late in life. The book that I've just finished writing, we will be appearing next year, is a book of three parts. The first part is all about myth busting, and most of the second part is about solutions. And I've gone out and sort of used certain cities as case studies, interviewed people involved in transport, like Sir Peter Hendy and Ken Livingstone in London, for example. And then the final chapters are looking at sort of drawing conclusions. And the last one is entitled, What Can I Do? And it answers that question from sort of three perspectives, really. The first, that of, from the point of view of the sort of the foot soldiers of transport planning, and I've interviewed people who were willing to talk anonymously off the record about how they have personally pursued agendas which are slightly different from those of their employers. And secondly, from the point of view of campaigning and drawing on sort of my own personal experience from that point of view. And so after sort of starting work as an academic, I have carried on with different forms of environmental campaigning. And that raises a number of sort of challenges. One of the things that I've noticed over the years, particularly is with the growth of sort of online discussion, is that debate about controversial issues has become ruder. It has become more normal to personally abuse people whom you disagree with. And so, you know, for example, I now run a campaign called Living Hard for Bristol, the aim of which is all about trying to remove traffic from, particularly through traffic, from the central areas of Bristol. And, you know, I personally have had accusations levelled against me that I was misusing university funds and assets for sort of promoting these sorts of things, and questions as to whether the mayor of Bristol was secretly funding our small campaign, which I thought was quite amusing, if only it was true. Now, to what extent should transport researchers get involved in campaigning? Obviously, that raises a whole series of broader questions about the question of values and objectivity. Is it possible to be objective about questions which relate to public policy? Of course, there's a whole sort of debate out there as to whether it is or it isn't. And I guess linked to that, does personal involvement in campaigning compromise any claim to objectivity which you may have in your own research and the presentation of it? My personal view on that is that it might, but it doesn't necessarily have to, and it can have the opposite effect. That one of the things which it can make you do is to focus more carefully and more specifically on that distinction between values and evidence, and where you are making an argument because of the values which you hold. I tend to take the view that you do it openly. You declare up in front, you know, look, this is where I am coming from a values perspective, and I am going to show you a certain amount of evidence which, whether you agree with those values or not, I hope you will find of use. And if your values are different, you may well be able to draw different conclusions from them. An awful lot of, I think, what goes on in transport debate actually disguises that. I think that differences about values are often sort of subsumed within, in some cases, some fairly spurious arguments about evidence or the lack of it. One thing, interestingly, which I haven't found is I appear from time to time in the local and the regional media, sometimes as a campaigner, but that hasn't also, it hasn't stopped them from also sometimes interviewing me as a sort of transport expert. And one of the interesting things is that they talk to you as if you were a different person on each occasion. And it would be interesting to hear any of your experiences on that. Last point again, question, thought I just wanted to throw out is that I spend the other country whose political culture I know best is France, where I've lived for a while, speak the language and that. And I've noticed a very big difference in the role of the public intellectual in particular, and that there's a whole stream in sort of French literature, you know, people like Pierre Bourdieu, who have written very strongly about the duty of intellectuals to engage in political debate. And there is still a degree of credence given to public intellectuals, whereas in this country, to some extent, that is all to be seen as an intellectual is almost a handicap. It's another possibility to abuse somebody, which I have noticed in debate, and I would be interested to hear any of your reflections or experience likewise. Thanks.
Thank you very much. That was very succinct. thank you very much. And so next we have... Just get your name correct.
Alan
Munro, who is lots of different things, and I made a note of it here. You are an expert in lots of things, including technology, ethnography, which I'm not even sure I know what that is, especially lots of things to do with transport and urban environments, virtual environments, interaction design, but you're also a transport campaigner.
Yes.
So you have a lot of different expertise to bring to this debate.
So probably jack of all trades and master of none, but I'll start off. I just my first year at Glasgow University as an undergraduate, at that time, because I'm quite ancient, I got as my matriculation card a little bit of board, and it was kind of a little bit of kind of linen-backed board. And it said on it, Jus Universitatis Glasgowensis, Civis Universitatis Glasgowensis. So I was a citizen of the University of Glasgow. And I started thinking about that when I was thinking about this, the role of universities, the role of universities in activism, and the role particularly of academics. And so I started thinking about, well, hold on, because now we have universities which, from the outside, sometimes look like call centres, and you might sort of form the conclusion after you've seen some of the syllabuses that the interior is somewhat like a call centre. I'll talk a little bit about that later, but I went back to actually look at the meaning of university. And generally, the interesting thing about university is it's nothing to do with universal. It doesn't come from that root. It comes from universitatis, which actually, from the Italian, means a collaborative corporation. So basically, the Italian idea is it's somewhat like a guild. A university was a guild of people, a guild of scholars. So Bologna started off as a guild of scholars coming together to do work, scholarship, to learn and to teach each other. Now, the German term universitas actually more means corporate town. Again, there's this idea of a community of people to do it. Now, there's a number of different elements to this. The ancient universities of Oxford and Cambridge generally had the idea that everyone was part of this community, students as well as faculty, whereas universities like Glasgow and Edinburgh had the idea that the faculty was the university, the students didn't stay there, but once you graduated into the life of the university. So I'm a member of the General Council of Glasgow. Now this sounds a bit old hat in this modern corporate age, but actually this is what a university is. It's a community of scholars. If you're an academic in a university, you are a scholar. You have a moral purpose in that institution. And I'm talking like someone from, you know, another age, but I think we've got to refine this, rediscover this in our universities when we talk nowadays about management groups and management committees. I'll give you another vignette, and this happened actually while I was a postdoc at Oxford University Computing Labs. And there was a business school that was going to be built in university land. It was university land that the researchers used to play cricket. The researchers lobbied everyone. There was going to be a vote on it because that's how the university worked. It voted on things. So congregation came together to vote. All the researchers lobbied against the business school, and the business school was defeated. And people were saying, well, this is incredible that this Ruritanian structure runs like this. But this is university democracy, and I'd like to see more of it. I think this is a real university, and there's more universities should be like this. Now, my thinking here is that the academic is the main bedrock of the university. You are, if you're an academic in a university, you are this molecular unit in the university. Now, what do you do if your research is particularly on transport and it comes to certain conclusions? Do you just stay within the academic world? I was thinking of examples of this, and thinking of someone like Joseph Lister in antiseptic medicine. And this is a good example of an academic who finds that particular approach in surgery saves a lot of lives. And the research is pretty much bomb-proof. So he doesn't stay in the academic world with this research. He goes out, he becomes an activist in this. Those terms weren't really around then. But he becomes someone who promotes the antiseptic model. And if you are someone within transport research, you might think something like the bicycle is the perfect answer to a lot of urban ills. There's enough research about this out there. You could drop the research on someone, it would kill them. I mean, there's so much research about this. So my answer is, why are you not an activist? And I'm going to kind of take another angle to this. And there's a lovely thing that came about. It was a kind of answer to cognitive science. And there was a particular approach in cognitive science about interaction, which talked about a script. And scripts would be formed. If you went into a restaurant, you'd chug through a restaurant script. But it didn't understand the essential reflexivity of language. So you meet a colleague in the corridor, you say hi to them, they say hi. That's the end of the script, yeah? But what if they don't say hi? This does not just stop the script. This is something else. This is asking for an account. This is accountable. Because they don't say hi, you do not just stop and go into something else. You spend your time asking for an account of why there was no hi. Did you do something? Is there something wrong? And academics, to an extent, are like that. I think we are constantly like that. We need to account. And we need to account when, particularly if we are in transport, if you're in transport, if you are dealing with questions of the rightness of certain forms of transport, the risk approaches, if your research leads that way, there's no sense you cannot give an account on it. So there is another question, there's another quite important point that if your research may lead to activism, but will activism lead to good research? And I'd say activists have to be very careful when they're doing research, because you can end up becoming quite tunnel vision. You're still an academic, and an academic is different from an activist. You are there to conduct your scholarship wherever it may lead, and maybe your activism may change. So I'd say really we are part of, and I really actually think we're part of a commons, an academic commons, which once was the whole of the academic world. It's been somewhat enclosed by intellectual property issues, but we are still part of a large commons of the academic world. And it behoves us to be activists if our research leads to it. Now, there are ideas, and Steve's brought this up as well, about neutrality. And I find neutrality a really interesting issue, because you could say just now we have an interesting idea of what neutrality is in a very much a neoliberal concept of economic life, which we are all somewhat meant to hold. So anyone to the left of that is somewhat skewed. But there were times when neutrality meant being able to hold slaves. There's a lovely example, actually, in an American website, something like Action for the Family, that it's some sort of astroturfed right-wing website that talks about academics should be neutral in the culture wars, and neutrality means actually you can't be pro-gay marriage. That's neutrality. So the whole question of neutrality is rather loaded, and really I don't see much point in being neutral. If you're in the centre of the road, you're going to get run over in both directions. That's my spiel. So yes, we should be activists, and we should change our universities back into being democracies. Up the revolution.
Thanks, Alan. That was excellent. So this sort of time is now to open up the debate. It's not supposed to just be questions to the speakers. It is supposed to be a very open debate. So if there are extra points you want to raise, a whole other thing you want to put forward as well, the questions to the speakers welcome to, because they've raised a lot of very, very interesting points, not least the different way you're treated when you're a campaigner or an expert. Every so often we are asked to comment as transport campaigners, Stephen and I, as, you know, commentators, and it is so different. It is so weird when they start to, hang on a minute, you're listening to me. You're not going to challenge my point, are you? You're just going to let it stand. It's amazing. So that's my contribution. Who has questions or questions they want to add to this debate? You were first at the back there, followed by you.
Both Stephen and Alan made me think of something that goes on a lot at where I work at BAM. That interesting thing, I loved your point about the ownership of neutrality there, I thought it was fantastic. We've got a tobacco research group who are, to all intents and purposes, campaigners. And sometimes, you know, you go onto the university news page and you say, oh God, how have you discovered how tobacco is evil today? because every day it's another revelation about how evil this is. And I do like to tease them when I talk to them and say, look, stop kicking them while they're down. Come and join me and tell a majority that their behaviour is wrong, rather than telling a minority who've already accepted that their behaviour is wrong. You know, once again, you're still wrong. No more questions there. I'm thinking particularly on what Stephen was saying here. Nobody even bats an eyelid that this, the line has got blurred between research and campaigning for tobacco. Because I guess, and this is where it becomes more speculative, I guess we've kind of passed the tipping point on that issue in terms of the public discourse about tobacco. But of course, the tobacco industry did not go down without a fight. It lasted for 60, 70 years. Now, again, going back to what Sean talked about earlier, and the Jeremy Clarkson issue, maybe we're heading towards that, but could it be several more decades before the very powerful moneyed interests of the car and oil lobbies do actually allow us to reach a point where it is unremarkable for Steve to be an academic who campaigns against private motoring? And I'll just throw another idea on top of that, and then I'll stop talking, because again, the earlier talks made me think of this as well. With media, especially local media, presumably a large amount of their income comes from car adverts, which might be another aspect in terms of maintaining the sort of discourse that you were talking about earlier, Sean.
Interesting. You were next, and then I've got a question over there, and Roger after that.
Yeah, it's following on from that, I think, because it seems to me it might be useful to think a bit more carefully about what exactly we mean by campaigning. Because there is a tendency in public discourse to assume that a campaign is only someone who is deliberately associated with a particular organisation which has a particular set of values or views to promote. But of course, you know, as an academic, all research has a point of view. No research is value-free. So you analyse data and you choose how you're going to present it, whether you're teaching or giving a conference paper or writing a journal article. And in a sense, you are always putting forward a point of view, which could be seen as campaigning, whether or not it's associated with a particular group. So I think it's perhaps useful to think about the way in which those lines get blurred and why some things are called academic research, when actually they're not value-free at all, they have a point of view, and other things are called, you know, loaded or biased because they come from a campaign group, and how those fit together rather uneasily, I think, in the public mind.
Bruce?
Yeah, I have a similar question actually. I'm coming from an arts and humanities direction. I understand researchers making arguments, is that rhetoric, rather than neutrality or objectivity. That's what academic scholarship constitutes. And there's an issue here around, you know, precisely what we define by an academic and an activist as well. One of the roles of an academic is to present a case, to argue a position. So but there are questions of sort of definition and terminology that immediately come into view here, I think.
Roger, you were... No.
Yeah, Roger Geffen from the Campaigns and Policy Director at CTC, so definitely here as a campaigner, and very useful to be having this discourse of, around the links between campaigns and academics. I suppose I just want to pick up on from Ian's point. I guess really, you know, even the idea, when does a campaign cease to be a campaign and just that normal opinion? Well, you know, I suppose that in itself sort of suggests that for this purpose, at any rate, the campaigner is somebody who's trying to change something that is part of the dominant paradigm. And when they succeeded, then they cease to become a campaigner, and then, as you say, the tobacco industry, the anti-tobacco campaigning ceases to be campaigning, it's just become mainstream. So, you know, in that sense, you're right. All research has opinions. The important bit is whether those opinions are contesting mainstream opinions, and at which point you can expect to get more careful scrutiny from, as it were, the economic vested interests that you are trying to counter. That is the source of pressure that, for me as a campaigner, absolutely forces me to try and do my damnedest to be intellectually rigorous in my campaigning and to draw, and this is why it's so important for me to be able to draw on research. We've got more time to do primary research than I'm ever going to be able to do as a campaigner. I need to know where the evidence base for anything I say, I need absolutely need to know where it comes from. So it's really, really useful stuff to have that. But just to come back to that point about how does this relate to those points about safety and the comparative safety of road and rail? You know, because this too is a place where, you know, as soon as you start saying about saying things about road safety, particularly from a cyber campaigner's point of view, you are questioning an important bit of the dominant paradigm. And the way in which road and rail safety is different is that, you know, rail safety, maritime safety, all of those other, you know, other they are operated by a system. all those transport modes are managed systems. The road is basically not a managed system. It is actually the one environment in which there were normal, basically law-abiding, mostly law-abiding people might kill another human being. There's nothing else like that. And this is one of the places, this is what makes it a place which is actually very difficult to say, well, we need to regulate that, because then you're not just regulating some large corporation like Network Rail or whoever, it's actually regulating a lot of citizens. And that's why, as soon as you say we've got to kind of do more 20 MPH spinning, we need to stronger roads policing, traffic law and enforcement, hey, that's going to come down on an awful lot of Jeremy Clarkson's. And that's why you kind of get these sort of media myths that 20 MPH speed limits are really unpopular, possibly seeded by that point about media advertising, which I suspect is itself a distorting factor in media portrayal of transport.
I think that's a really good point. Monica had a hand up here, and then I'll come back to you.
Yeah, well, I was thinking that there are quite a lot of resonances with the workshop that we had on designing mobilities. Because when I tried to think what's the opposite of an activist, and for me that's not a scholar, it's actually a designer, and you can be a designer and a scholar. So I was thinking that when we're talking about mobilities here, we're not talking about campaigning against one form of mobility against another, but we're actually talking about mobility systems. And so what you as a campaigner or as an activist or as a designer or as a scholar, what I'm involved in is revealing the complexities of it and the unintended consequences and trying to make them anticipatable. And I would see my role as making it possible for collectives to experiment with alternative mobilities in a way that is as knowledgeable as possible about those complexities and unintended consequences. So, very thought-provoking, but very interesting.
Alan, you wanted to come back.
Well, no, yeah. I don't know if the opposite of an activist is a designer. I would actually say, for example, in my other life as pedal in Parliament, we've actually been pushing forward designs like the Dutch Crow roundabout design, where, you know, we're constantly saying, look, this is a way to design in safety, and we're constantly talking about designing in safety and the importance of infrastructure. I was going to say something about Roger's point about safety, and yeah, I mean, there's the dominant ideology about, you know, your car is freedom. And I think actually a bit of intellectual rigour, a bit of academic rigour can take these things apart. Like we were talking about rhetoric. You can say, well, you know, every Top Gear thing showing the new Lamborghini shows a road in Iceland or Skye where they don't have a lot of cars, so it's empty. Well, not Skye, because the Lamborghini couldn't ride on it. But, you know, some Scottish islands, you know, where there's about three cars, and there's a Lamborghini riding around. They don't show it in, you know, in Slough town centre on a Saturday afternoon, you know, going at 3 miles an hour. And these things are... You know, they're a rhetorical framework put into this whole series of metaphors about driving as freedom, etc. As soon as you face cycling, if you're a non-cyclist, will suddenly go into a whole different analogical framework. Oh, it's a bit dangerous. Oh, it's a bit this. And you can actually counter it with rigorous academic research, saying, well, actually, the health benefits of cycling versus the risk are something like 20 to 1. Do you want to know the risk of your child contracting a chronic condition if you protect them, if you take them in a car everywhere, if you don't let them walk, it's something like 50%. And that is the research, that's lifespan research about sedentary lifestyles. This is what the sofa does to you. This is the absence of activity. So you can actually counter those things with a good intellectual argument. The activist side of you tries to simplify it into something that people will read.
I would argue there's a lot more to campaigning than that.
Yes, and I know,
that's my profession.
Absolutely.
Steve, did you want to?
But as an activist, academic, is that?
Yeah, I just picking up several points. To what extent, where is that blurred line between academics doing what they normally do anyway and campaigning? And I think it gets, apart from the organisational thing, I think it comes where you actually go beyond talking about what your own research has found. And so by definition, you are having to talk about things where perhaps you are slightly less confident. Because you're trying to say something about the bigger picture or something specific about some specific issue in your area or whatever. This thing about the point Monica made about it's our job making it possible, I thought it was an interesting point because that goes back to, I mentioned earlier on, Pierre Bourdieu, who made a really brilliant speech. I don't know whether it was ever translated into English, but he made a speech to a trade union conference where it's sort of very strong, published in Le Monde, called Pour un savoir engagé, where what he is saying is, we have a duty to do this kind of stuff. And his argument was going that, he was particularly talking about neoliberalism and so researcher looks around and finds that neoliberalism is creating all these problems in society, we have a duty to speak out. And in particular, as he saw it, the role of the sort of the intellectual in this sort of context was to invent new ways of living. And he sort of drew an analogy with the first people who proposed democracy in the United States, the time of their War of Independence, or taking independence. And the idea is that nobody, possibly since the ancient Greeks, had actually tried anything like this before. How do we know it's going to work? And therefore, one of the things that we, I think, all need to do is to actually go beyond what we can see at the moment and say, look, how could we organise things in a better way that we haven't yet seen? And that means in a way that we don't actually yet have evidence on, because nobody's actually done it.
If I could join in at this point, has anyone else got their hands up, by the way? Okay, I'll come to you in a second. As a campaigner, one of the things that really frustrates me at the moment is how much of the previous knowledge that we get into about transport, and particularly road building and the SACTA reports from the 1990s, is that the current government's completely forgotten them. And it seems like it needs it reproving to itself. And if you were to ask me, what would I like to see researched, it wouldn't be new things particularly. I would like someone to go and reprove that so that the government can take on board again the thing it used to know when it was a different government, obviously, but that it seems to have forgotten. And that really frustrates me. The other point I would make is, I'm fairly convinced, I obviously work for a sustainable transport charity, that sustainable transport is the right answer to our transport problems. So I'm not in any way frightened or worried or wishing to control the research agenda. I just want more and more and more research to go on and more of the research to be communicated well to people, because I'm confident that it will all back up our points. And what Monica said about, quoting her correctly, she said part of her job was making it possible for communities to experiment with as much information as possible is just brilliant. I think that's absolutely great. I think giving people the ability to research for themselves and try out things and see what works for them could be really, really the answer. Yeah, because it combines the two things a little bit. So, is it Robin?
Yeah, I've just got kind of three points that link to a lot of what's being said, and I find it a really interesting discussion, both personally and kind of more generally. And I've never heard of campaigning defined, you know, it's difficult to define campaign. You're always trying to, I guess, trying to change the world. But Roger said it's, you can define it as challenging the dominant ideology, and that kind of links to myth busting. I think that's a good way of seeing when lots of the academics should try, like at the most fundamental, should be searching for the truth. You know, that's a kind of definition that I think is, you know, a lot of people would agree with. And really like the link, I hadn't heard many people talking about the duty of academics is to kind of be foot soldiers thinking about where we're going as a society, because if academics don't do it, who else is, you know? Most people are employed either by the public or private sector. Why should they think about every day, wake up, are we doing the right thing? So that links to another, the second point that I wanted to make, which I think is very relevant to academics. It's like, maybe our role is to just ask questions, ask difficult questions. Are the dominant ideologies based on sound evidence and bringing the evidence base in there? I personally believe that there is a objective reality out there, and if we can try and bring evidence from that to bear on the current problems and we arrive at certain conclusions, then I certainly think it's our duty to communicate that in a clear way. Yeah, and the final thing is comes from me being very proud of myself, being a kind of academic activist, but kind of under the radar to some extent. I'm a big advocate of open source technology, and I believe that has the ability to empower people and to encourage the democratization of technology, which is a hugely important theme. So I was kind of saying to my housemate, who's a bit of an activist, like, oh yeah, well, I'm having successes in getting more of the modules taught using open source technology. And he turned around and said, okay, in this meeting, what wasn't being said? I was like, well, lots of things weren't being said. He was like, yeah, exactly. So the dominant ideology is the one that isn't stated explicitly. And I thought that was a really good point, because, you know, me, by virtue of being in the academic system and in some way implicitly trying to get established in that, I'm a very early career researcher, by the way, you're kind of reinforcing that system in itself, which is a subset of the neoliberal capitalist agenda. So the conclusion is that we need to ask questions and we need to challenge dominant ideologies explicitly. And I just, you know, thought I'd throw that out there. My contribution.
Thank you very much. Tim, I think you had your hand up before as well.
Yeah, it's more the kind of academic link to the campaign. As I had an experience kind of years ago in Northern Ireland, where I was in the North Cycling campaign, and I was an academic, and I was a member of the community using the pedestrianisation things. And you kind of, which hat am I putting on here? So it's in that blur. I think that the thing from an academic perspective is the academic landscape that's changing, being aware of that. I've just felt it recently, that if you're an established member of staff, you've got this whole stuff like the REF process and your research funders and your impact of your research. Well, I don't really recognise impact on when you get media coverage as much, or certainly where I'm in an engineering school, or things like your impact is more impact into documents and evidence that you can show that. So when it comes to bringing things out, and I had a piece, when was it, about 4 years ago in The Guardian, but I didn't have time to respond to, I would have liked to have done the way it came out later than I thought, and I would have quite liked to have a certain bit and I had a slightly different angle, but it's having the time to deal with it properly. I had a lot of things coming back at me that I would like to have had more time to respond, and so I kind of see a bit of the academic into the consultant. There's a lot of stuff I would like to do, and I would like to kind of get out of the campaign, but it's a question of time and pressures from the academic job that do make it difficult at times. And when you do get a chance, and you do, it's being able to deal with some of these things because of the, the things coming back at you from different, whatever the topic is. And the other thing about, I mean, I would kind of say, well, you're trying to be objective in your research, but actually a lot of the funders that we have are not always objective. So if you're going for research council funding, or if you're particularly also, if you're going for government money, you've got to kind of, I suppose you've got to bring back their kind of policies and arguments. So it's actually, there's values actually embedded in research that you're doing that's objective. So if I do some work for a government-related body, and I come up with some objective value, they may not like some bits to be published, and I've got a bit of pressures at the moment or something like that. So it's not as simple as an academic campaign. We get different academic pressures coming at us from within the university, which Steve mentioned that bit, but also from our funders as well. That could be quite difficult. So I'll throw more things out.
Alan wanted to speak, I think. And then I'll...
Yeah, I mean, there's the... Oh, I forgot what I was going to say, but... the universities, you could liken them throughout the ages to being somewhat courtesans, because what a university would do is, it grew up under... If you talk about Robin Lakoff about metaphoric frameworks, grew up under a religious framework, generally. These communities of scholars coming together to study generally religious things. Then along come things from the Moorish world, and you get translations of Aristotle and you get Plato. So gradually this sort of starts warping, and you get Aristotelianism and taken into Catholicism. But gradually there's warping of these metaphors as gradually things like the Renaissance coming along. The Renaissance is very much an Eastern thing as well as a Western thing. It's the trade from the Arabic world bringing in new knowledge, new ideas of algebra. So, and universities, I think, are at their best in a kind of Renaissance Enlightenment model. That's where they work. That's a scholarship. And now they're warping again, because you've got the analogical framework of a university as a training establishment for the purchase of degrees, essentially a neoliberal. And there's some really interesting things happening which shows that this analogical framework just is not working, and the grinding of it. And just now there's a post-crash economic society. I started in Manchester, and they've already put letters into the newspapers basically saying economics training and teaching in Manchester, well, they call it training because they say it's multiple choice, it's of one particular view, and that's the only view you can talk about. You can't talk about economic crashes because that's not really covered by the neoliberal theory, supply-side economics. So you can talk about this, you can't talk about that. So they're saying, this is crazy, this is not an academic subject anymore. An academic subject is the result of scholarship, not dogma. So these things are starting to... I would hope there was more of that challenging, because... the academic world, a degree is not actually about learning stuff. It's about gaining an attitude to knowledge, to be able to open source it to an extent. You take the stuff and you can do things. You can put a new framework on it. You present it rigorously, but you can do that.
I picked Walter out in the corner there a second ago.
Sure.
But Steve will come back after that.
Okay. Well, just to that point, there's this sort of temporalization of, I have another thought, but of the university education as originally being as a privilege, and then sort of in the early to middle 20th century as a right, and now it's compulsory. And your last sort of comment that it's which is running as an attitude toward a certain body of knowledge may not actually even pertain for many people in a compulsory system, because it's got nothing to do with the knowledge per se. It's got everything to do with the accreditation to be able to apply for certain jobs that formerly, if you came out of secondary, you'd be able to do. So in that sense, it's almost as though what you're learning is almost beside the point. But my other thought had to do with how some of this discussion appears. It seems to me to rely a little bit on a sort of rational assumption about information and how people know or how they want to believe or they want to relate to sort of empirical things. And this is largely, my thoughts are largely kind of informed by coming from the States, and you know, which is just kind of a fantasy land in some places with respect to just kind of empirical data, right? It's not a question of reproving what you already know or representing things that, you know, whatever. It's a question of how people choose to believe, and in some cases you say, okay, well, some ideological positions are so entrenched that you can't change them, but then that's kind of an impasse, right? So then it's almost, what I'm thinking is that it's not so much a question of producing new knowledge or even producing new possibilities for how you do something, but producing effective ways for transmitting ideas, which is, your name is pronounced Sean?
Sean, yes, sorry.
Okay. You know, when you mentioned that there was like that chart that was disseminated through, and sometimes you get the kind of return trip,
right? Yeah, yeah.
Through social media, that really kind of says something, you know, making that kind of thing, making that kind of almost mimetic sort of transmission of information, but of course then the receptors you have to it have a little bit more to do with kind of your ideological perspective.
I'm in quite a bubble of transport people, like, yeah, where this happens, obviously.
Yeah. Okay, but things come around all the time, right? They come around probably for everybody via Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So then the question, at least as I'm thinking of it now, is how does the already existing, you know, at least to those maybe amongst sitting in the room who would believe that actually when you turn your car on, there should be a little noise that rather than ding says there's some fairly high likelihood that you may die in this, right? Just like when you open your packet of smokes, it says smoking kills. Mm-hmm. Like, you have a high likelihood of killing somebody or killing yourself in this vehicle. But, like, there's no shortage of information there. There's no shortage of information in terms of environmental stuff. It's all a question of traversing the sort of previously assumed to be rational divide, but divide that now is something else. And then how, you know, it's not even just academic or campaigner or advocate so much as almost a third position that translates between that, you know, what you want to believe and other possibilities.
Steve, do you want to come back? We've got literally 5 minutes, so I'm going to look around the room and grab a few final hands of people I missed before. So you and you, okay, go on.
Okay, to pick up the two points. Having the time, I really sympathise with what Tim is saying, and I've made quite a radical personal decision on that. I had to fight to be able to get down to 3.5 days a week, and I try to mentally, I think the mental discipline of saying either I am acting as an academic now or I am acting as a campaigner or a freelance journalist. The book that I've written, it's not an academic book, it's the Without the Hot Air is a series, have you seen Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air? It's putting across the, sort of technical ideas in a non-technical way for the general public, and I wrote all of that in my spare time. And I felt that was very liberating because I don't have to account to anyone in the university and it's not peer reviewed and I will write what I want to write. That may not be career enhancing, but it's one way of trying to combine the two things. Yeah, rationality. Yeah, I mean, this is obviously an issue. Academics, by the nature of what we do, we have to have some innate belief that a rational argument may eventually carry the day. Unfortunately, those of us who are involved in campaigning find that the role of rational evidence in changing things is relatively limited. And one of the conclusions that my book comes to is in a sense, we as a campaigner, in campaigning mode, we have to be realistic and limited in our objectives. Simply showing that something is rationally absurd will not in itself change it. And one of the conclusions I've come to in the book is that there may be something about human beings that means that they are incapable of doing the right thing for the right reasons. So therefore, a lot of the time, what we have to look for are favourable unintended consequences. And that if we want to change, so for example, one of the things which may help us to achieve more sustainable transport in our cities are NIMBY campaigns against greenfield building. for example, and so some of the book talks about that. How we go about it as campaigners, how we actually make use of this information, how we change the decision-making process, there's a bit about that in the book, but I suspect that that would probably be another conference all in itself.
Okay, so John and Tom, is Tom? Sorry, I haven't learnt everyone's names today.
I was thinking about these issues because about a decade ago I was invited to the meetings of the Freedom to Fly organisation, and at that meeting I went to, there were also some well-known other transport academics and so on. And I was invited, and I guess these other people were, because a lot of what I've been writing about mobilities is to do with the significance of co-presence. And that is, the why and how people travel is to do with the various kinds of co-presence, and that requires quite extensive forms of transport. And indeed, when we talk about universities, for example, one of the great things about universities is collegiality, and collegiality across borders, across continents and so on. So I kind of thought this makes the issue of campaigning and academic work actually pretty complicated, often contradictory, even held within the same, contrary views held within the same person. So I guess that sort of slightly goes along with the people who've been critiquing a kind of simple rational model. This is the evidence, this and research. These are the political outcomes. There are diverse outcomes and, of course, diverse interests to organising and mobilising.
Tom?
The one that's been resonating for me was Helen's mention of Lister, who, if I've got this right, was relatively lucky compared with the transport academic, because the objective was quite straightforward. It would be preserving life in a situation of ill health. And maybe I'm wrong, and maybe this is one of these things that change depending on the frame, but it seems to me that transport researchers are working in a far more contingent world where preservation of life is just one consideration alongside all sorts of others about the desire to travel and the opportunities that it brings. And so I'm just tussling with this question of whether it's possible to be the transport equivalent of Joseph Lister and what that looks like. It's a question I continue to tussle.
Go on, Alan.
Right. Lister was up against, he had good evidence that antiseptic surgery worked. He had good evidence that if you change your aprons regularly, if you wash things, if you sterilise them using particular chemicals, they work. He was up against surgeons who actually boasted about, a lot of surgeons at that time were known as old stink-worthy. Oh. Something like this, they stank because they used the same apron again and again, and they relished the stains on the aprons. That was part of their whole professional demeanour. That's what they did. They cut people up. They got stains on their aprons, and they didn't wash. That was their thing. So he was up against the whole professional idea of what the surgeon was like, and the kind of Bohemian of the surgeon. So actually, no, there was a whole culture he had to change. Even though he had the scientific evidence, he still had a big fight in his hands. So it took a while for antiseptic surgery to be accepted. Same with Florence Nightingale with the effectiveness of nursing.
But was it not the case that in both of these scenarios there was an implicit desire to preserve life, even if these surgeons seemed to be following a path that wasn't going to lead to it?
Yes, there would have been.
And that's where I see the difference as lying, because I think transport is multifaceted, and that's why we have more of a chance. But as I say, it's not like I've got an answer, and it may just be that in time, the Joseph Lister of transport will be revealed in the same way that he was an outsider whilst he was doing his thing.
Well, he was the guy who invented the bicycle, I think.
Maybe.
I should make a stop now, because I said I would do it by 20 past, is that right? Would either of you like to say anything, or say anything about how the comments change your views in any way? Anything like that? Before we finish off,
I think it's been such a wide-ranging debate, it would be difficult to sum up. The only other thing I wanted to mention, which didn't have a chance, which probably won't come to the end of, is that earlier on in the debate somebody mentioned the decline of the print media and social media. From a practical campaigning point of view, that makes it very difficult, because much of the communication through social media is talking to the converted. And if you were actually trying to get out a wider message, it isn't evident quite how you should go about it through social media.
That's a
very good point.
I'd say, well, you know, there's maybe a place for, you were talking about the Americans rediscovering, well, the founders of the US fight, rediscovering an idea of, a Greek idea of democracy. Maybe we need to, maybe open source and rediscover an idea of scholarship that maybe is outside those institutions that call themselves universities, but looking at more like call centres. So, yeah.